All right, so we're going to be delving into week two of our apologetics. And so today we're going to be talking about engagement, so actually engaging in apologetics. And again, we talked about this last week, but you know, in our apologetics fellows, we actually have this as the last thing that we go through. But I think it's good to have this towards the beginning because the goal is to get you started and not to be afraid to get into conversations, so we're going to give you some tips right up front. Before I actually get started, here's the book that I use for this. Greg Kokel, you're going to hear me reference him quite a bit. And actually, just for your information, we're actually maybe going to try to get Greg to come here and speak at the church for a conference maybe in the fall if we can get things arranged. But this is his book, Tactics, and I'm going to tell you, if you haven't read apologetics before and you want two books to read to start off with that are just really, really good, I mean, it's going to, I think, help you to go way down the road very quickly, is his book, Tactics, and then the next week is The Story of Reality. Those are the two books, if you haven't read apologetics before, that I would say start with. It would be my opinion. All right? So let me begin in prayer, and then we can get started. All right? Father, I again thank you for this time. Thank you for the sunny Sunday that we get to come and worship. Lord, I pray especially that you would guide our time this morning as we're really seeking how to interact with others and do it in a gracious way and an effective way. Please guide my speech. Help us to think clearly this morning and to honor you in all that we do and say. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, so last week we talked about apologetics really and worldview, and we kind of focused on those two things since this is an apologetics class. So who can tell me, who can remember from last week, what's a summary, a basic summary of apologetics? What would you say? Defense of the faith. Good. I mean, that's a very simple way of saying it, right? See if I can get it to go to the next page here. Uh-oh. That ain't it. Okay, let's see if it'll go up and down. There we go. Got it to work. Okay. Okay. So, apologetics, using a reasoned statement or verbal defense to show that Christianity is true and that all non-Christian worldviews are false. And again, we talked about this, you know, sometimes people say, well, so here you are trying to tell us that you're right and we're wrong. But again, we talked about this last week. I'm assuming everybody thinks that. If you didn't believe what you believe, then you wouldn't believe it, right? So everyone thinks that, especially those who thought it through. And even those who haven't, really, they're assuming a lot of things and they think that it's true, or they probably wouldn't hold that view. So we're no different than others, right? But we're specifically talking about apologetics in the sense of being able to give answers for why we believe what we believe and also to cause others to think about their beliefs and what they're believing. Specifically aimed towards what? Because our goal isn't to just simply win a debate, is it? I hope not. Present the gospel. It's all gospel focused, right? So it's either in defense of the gospel or it's in preparation so that someone who doesn't even want to hear the gospel, maybe we can break down some barriers that they'll be willing to listen to us, okay? And then the second thing that we talked about last week was worldview. Anyone want to give that a shot? What's a brief summary of what a worldview is? Well, I did a great job last week. The way you see the world. It's everyone's story of reality. They have something in their mind that, of the way they think the world really is. All right? And so the reason this is important, I think, is because we're tempted. Somebody comes at us with a certain thing. Let's just use the example of homosexuality. It's a big topic today. So some people say, you know, they believe that homosexuality is fine. Say, people are born that way, or hey, live and let live, or whatever it might be. All right? And we're tempted to go right at that, at homosexuality. Well, it's true, the Bible does talk about that. It is a moral issue. But I think if you make it your goal to get behind that and find out, why do you hold this? right? In other words, if you believe there is no God and evolution is king, then what should happen to homosexuals? They should die out in one generation because there's no way to pass on their genes to the next generation. And what grounds would you say that they have any worth at all? Because, right, there's not survival of the fittest there, right? And you could, if they say they believe in God, then you can ask them, well, what does God say about this? If God made you, then shouldn't he be the one to determine, right? And so your goal there is to get behind this one issue, whatever that is, and get to a worldview, a big picture, the way they believe that the world really is, okay? And here in apologetics, and I meant to say this here for apologetics, but apologetics really aids in, and this is your first question in your handout there, aids in the evangelism of the unbeliever, aids in the evangelism of the unbeliever, and in the shepherding of believers, right? So we're trying to break down barriers for those who are unbelievers that either before the fact or maybe after the fact you share the gospel and then they have objections and you can answer those to break down those barriers, knowing that it's the Holy Spirit who changes hearts, right? So apologetics is really aimed towards the mind in that sense. For believers, it's shepherding. We all go through times of doubt. I'm just assuming that all of you are like me, and there have been times in the past where I will hear an argument, I'll read something, and it's like I've never thought of that before, and it causes me to doubt and to question. All right? Well, apologetics helps with that. It gives us good reasons to believe what we believe, right? We're aiming for that. All right? Okay, so we had this. There's the worldview. I'm sorry, I should have skipped on past there. This is the worldview, one's most fundamental beliefs about assumptions and assumptions about the universe you inhabit. Everyone has one, so this is what we talked about last week. That's important. And we said it's kind of like a box top. And I have that other picture here. So we just see our worldview would kind of be compared to this, and then all the pieces of life you're putting together to fit into that picture. All right? Okay, so this week we're going to be talking about engagement itself, so how to interact with others. So I have both of these books here. So Peter Boghossian is a professor. He's an atheist philosophy professor at Portland State University. And actually, if you get on Amazon, you can see both of these. And if you get on Amazon, that's a pretty popular book. He actually has disciples that go around trying to evangelize believers. They really like to evangelize Christians. I'm using that term evangelize in their sense, right? They think they have some good news, and they want to, in a sense, they want to spread this good news of skepticism or atheism, right? And that's their goal. In this book there, that's what he's specifically written for. This was just released here, and it's kind of interesting. This book here is actually very similar to Greg Kochel's book in a lot of ways, but he's writing that from an atheist perspective, all right? So this is what he says in this book, Peter Boghossian. This book will teach you how to talk to people out of their faith. That's why he's written this book. You'll learn how to engage the faithful in conversations that help them value reason and rationality. This is what he wants to do. To cast doubt on their beliefs and mistrust their faith. Now, I want you to notice as I'm reading this too, he's not talking about his own or his readers. He's telling them to go out to the others, to them, right? That's his focus. The goal of this book is to create a generation of people equipped with an array of dialectical and clinical tools who actively go into the streets, the prisons, the bars, the churches, the schools, and the community, into any and every place the faithful reside, and help them abandon their faith and embrace reason. Notice what he's done there, too. Abandon your faith and embrace reason, right? Yes, he's made this dichotomy and he's just thrown it in there like you have to abandon your faith in order to embrace reason, like there's something that's contradictory there, right? And he just keeps on going. Like I would want to stop him and say, go ahead.
He made an assumption there.
Right, he's making it. Good, right? And of course, he wrote the book. He can do that if he wants. But if he's talking to me, I'm going to say, hold on a second, stop. You've just made an assumption. I want to know, what do you mean by that? we're going to talk about this too, but what do you mean by that? Explain what you mean by that. All right. Boghossian continues with his vision for his followers to be an articulate, clear, helpful voice with an unremitting desire to help people overcome their faith and to create a better world. Again, assumptions. Somehow that's going to be a better world. He needs to show me that's going to be a better world. Right? Now, maybe he's right. He might be completely right in what he's saying. All right? Because we care about truth. But he's going to have to defend that. He's made some claims there. But he's going to present in his book, it's all about getting the other person, right, to really kind of trap the other person, I would say. And you can go online and watch videos. It's really sad. They have evangelists that post their stuff on YouTube, and they'll talk to believers, and by the end of the conversation, these believers will be completely befuddled by them. And the guys will go away and say, all right, yeah, got him, you know? And so that's kind of sad. Now, anyway, I don't have time to go into this, but Boghossian's actually become more of an ally of Christians, at least if you're conservative, in the last couple years because of some things, and you can read about him if you want. That book was probably 6 or 7 years ago. He says, this better world uses intelligence, reasons, rationality, thoughtfulness, ingenuity, sincerity, science, and kindness to help build the future. Again, he's made a lot of assumptions there. He hasn't proved. Not a world of faith, delusion, pretending, religion, fear, pseudoscience, superstition, or a certainty achieved by keeping people in a stupor that makes them pawns of unseen forces because they're terrified. I mean, he has packed this full of assumptions there without proving anything, right? He's made this dichotomy between the two groups without proving any of it, right? But that's his goal, all right? And he continues on and he says, he writes this, the words we use are important. They can help us see clearly, or they can confuse, cloud, or obscure issues. And then he says this, I will now offer my two preferred definitions of faith. And he plays on this the rest of his book. He has these two definitions of faith, and he just, anytime somebody says faith, he just plugs one of these two definitions in there. So, of course, if you word it a certain way, you can win any argument, right? I prefer the definition of borrowing. Well, he's stealing, but he prefers to define it as borrowing, right? So if he gets to define the terms, then what are you going to do to him? He's just borrowing it, right? Well, this is kind of what Boghossian's done. Here's the first definition. Faith without evidence. Notice he used his definition in his term that he's going to define in the definition itself. So faith without evidence, that's his first definition of faith. If one has sufficient evidence to warrant belief in a particular claim, then one wouldn't believe the claim on the basis of faith, so he says. Right? Second, pretending to know things you don't know. Faith would be like someone giving advice about baking cookies who has never been in a kitchen. So again, writer that I read said, he who defines the terms wins the debate. Well, Peter's defined his terms at the very beginning, and he's defined it in such a way that it's going to be slanted in a certain direction. I wrote this, my preferred definition of an atheist is one who pretends to foolishly deny the overwhelming scientific evidence for a creator. Well, if I get to define my terms that way, then every atheist is going to look utterly foolish, right? But they would not accept my definition just because I used that definition, all right? Okay, so in his book, Boghossian has a strategy to ask questions, which is what we're going to be pushing for, so it's not a bad idea what he's saying, but he's doing it with a certain bent. Many times loaded questions, as we've shown already, with the goal of causing doubt and distress in the believer's mind, right? So he's trying to put a stone in their shoe, and that's what we're going to be doing here in a bit, too. Most of those with whom we interact do not have that same purposeful goal. When you're talking to normal people, that's not their goal. Right, generally speaking, you might find some that's the case, or his disciples. However, many do have a similar perspective in that they think that it is only the Christian believer who needs to defend. They think it's just us, but it's not just us. All right, we should be able to defend what we believe, but so should they. All right, and we're going to push back a little bit. They think that they only need to make claims and ask questions, and their job is done. All right, and so that's what they think. So I'm going to just ask you to consider some of these, and we're going to address these as we continue on here. But I want you to consider some of the claims and charges of skeptics, and you might have heard some of these. There's many more. I just grabbed a few of them that I'm going to be addressing here as we go. The Bible was corrupted very early in the church age. Right? So I have a picture up here of somebody pulling a page out of a book. Right? And so they say it was corrupted very early in the church. Right? That's one claim. You can't legislate morality. Have you heard that before? You can't legislate morality. God does not take sides in moral or political arguments. Pete Buttigieg just said a couple weeks ago, God does not take sides in political debates and political,
Did you ask him?
Well, there's a lot of things you could say to that, right? So then why bring it up? Because he's not taking your side either, right? That's what you might say. Is he on your side or my side? Neither side? Then why are you bringing him up? Doesn't take sides, right? Keep your religious opinions to yourself. How about that one? Capital punishment is wrong because Jesus forgave sinners. Have you heard that one before? Homosexuality is not wrong because people were born that way.
People are born alcoholics too.
People are born lots of ways. Christianity is basically the same as all other religions. Okay? Now there's many, many more, but here's just some examples. And you maybe have had conversations with people and they're going to throw things like this out at you. Now, first of all, we should not be afraid of defending our own truth, right? And I will say too, there might be times where somebody throws something at you you haven't heard before. And we're going to address some of that. But if you don't have an answer, you don't have an answer. Tell them that. That's a good point. Can I get back to you on that one, right? That's always a good comeback. If you give them a silly response, then they're going to see right through it. So if you don't know, then just say, that's a good point. I don't know, right? Think about yourself. If you're talking with someone else and they say, well, that's a really good point. Let me check on that. You're going to have really more respect for them than if they just say something silly in response, all right? And you're not going to have all the answers. Last week we learned that it is not Christian believers alone who need to defend their beliefs. Since everyone believes something about reality, okay, so we want to remember that. Over the next few weeks, we'll begin to learn the information, the knowledge that we will need in order to be effective apologists. That's our goal over this the next few weeks. Today, however, we will lay down a foundation for how to maneuver in conversation in such a way that we do not need to have all the answers, nor feel the need to be defensive. Okay, so strategy is a plan of action designed to achieve a major goal or overall aim, right? So that would be the strategy. It's the big picture. And in our sense, the big picture is the gospel, the Great Commission, all right? Tactics, however, is a little different. Tactics is the art and science of individual maneuvering in the midst of a plan of action. In other words, individual conversations. We know what our big goal is. What about the individual conversations? How do you interact in those individual conversations, right? And that's what we're going to be talking about today. So I have the little cartoon up here. Those online, and I just say this to whoever's listening, I'm going to be posting the slides so you can get online and access those too if you want to look at the slides that we're looking at. All right? So in his book Tactics, Greg Kuchel, that's the book I was telling you about earlier, says that Christians should approach each encounter as ambassadors rather than combatants. All right, we are ambassadors. His advice flows well from what Scripture itself teaches. 2 Corinthians 5:20 says, therefore, we are ambassadors for Christ, God making his appeal through us. We implore you on behalf of Christ, be reconciled to God. All right, so this is what Scripture says. So if we're approaching it in that way, we are ambassadors for Christ. So we're going to be interacting in that way. And we're God given us reason. We want to use that reason, all right? And we're not fighting. We're not in it to fight. We're in it as ambassadors. We're representing Christ. So ambassadors for Christ in any area require three skills. And this is according to Greg Kuchel, and I think he's right on this, right? Knowledge, wisdom, and character. So knowledge is an accurately informed mind. Know what you believe and why you believe it. It's important for us to do, all right? Wisdom, an artful method. This is what we're going to be focused on today, by the way, is wisdom. This artful method. In other words, being able to apply the knowledge into an effective interaction with others. And then character is an attractive manner. We are representatives of Christ and therefore must imitate him in our conduct and conversation. I said this to coworkers before. I had one coworker that came to Christ at some point. He was 47 before he was saved, but he didn't have the best work ethic. And he was on fire, you know, when he first came to faith, but he still wasn't the best worker. And I kept trying to say, when you come to work, if you're a bad worker, people aren't going to listen to what you're saying. You know, you need to be a good worker at work. And that was a character issue. Now, there's all kinds of things with character. When we're having one-on-one conversations, it might just be somebody at the store. But you can be abrasive, or you can be kind and respectful, all right? And our goal is to, of course, have attractive character, all right? So we're going to begin our tactical approach with the assumption that every Christian ought to have character. Hopefully you know that and you assume that, all right? We don't have to argue that. Over the next few weeks, we're going to be focused on the knowledge issue, but today, again, we're going to be talking about tactics. So here's a caution. The first general rule in our engagement is, if anyone in the discussion gets mad, you lose. Now, you can't help it completely, right? And again, we talked about this last week. The gospel is going to rile people up. It's just going to. Just make sure that it's not the way that I present it. I want to make sure it's not something in me that's doing it, but it's the message itself. All right? And a gentle answer turns away wrath is what Scripture says, and so sometimes that might have to be the response. But there's going to be some people that just get really angry. But you still lose. If you're in a conversation and somebody gets irate, then the conversation's over and you're not going to get anywhere, so you're still losing in that sense. All right? So the objective is to try the best you can to not do that. All right. Next, we talked about arguing and how that's actually a good thing, following the caution that we just gave. Many think that arguing should be avoided. Since character is important, they think we shouldn't argue. And, of course, again, depends on how you define argue. This, however, is to confuse arguing with quarreling or bickering, which is true. We don't want to do that. To argue in a biblical sense is to contend in a principled way for a truth that really matters. Okay, I'll say that again. To argue in a biblical sense is to contend in a principled way for truth that really matters. Okay? We will define arguing in this way and will advocate for arguing well. We talked about this last week. When we do that, we're actually treating the other person as an image bearer with dignity and respect. We're assuming they have the ability to reason, because God made them that way. And by talking to them, we're telling them that they're valuable. We care enough that we're going to talk to them. I can't remember. Is it Penn and Teller is the magicians comedians? And I can't remember which one it is. The tall guy. He's an atheist. But he had a conversation one time where he actually said, if Christians actually believe that I'm going to hell, how can they not tell me what they believe, right? If they actually believe it, then they're actually showing that they don't care about me at all if they're not trying to tell me. And this is from an atheist, okay? So if we believe that, then by trying to talk to others, we're actually showing that we believe that they were made in God's image. They are image bearers, okay? This does not mean, however, that all are willing to reason, only that they have the ability and ought to reason. And we're pushing for that as we're talking to them, all right? So, a modest goal. Keep this in mind. This is a modest goal, and this is what Greg Kokel says, and I actually agree with him. I think this is really good. This takes a whole lot of the pressure off of you, which the pressure should be off anyway, but this takes a lot of that pressure off. Of course, the gospel is the ultimate aim in apologetics. That's the ultimate aim. That's what we're shooting for is evangelism, right? But in conversations, it's a little bit different. Let's be honest, on many occasions, either time or circumstances do not permit us to, quote, get to the foot of the cross in every encounter. Surely you know that. Lots of conversations where you can't get, as Christians would say, to the foot of the cross. You can't get all the way there, all right? So some people just don't do anything at all. But we're going to push back a little bit here. This can tempt us to either not try or to rush the gospel in such a way that we sound clunky, contrived, or overly simplistic. Some might respond to this by saying that 1 Corinthians says the word of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, But to us who are being saved, it's the power of God. In other words, they're saying, well, sure, we should expect that because the gospel's foolishness, all right? So who cares if I sound foolish? Well, yes, but it should be the gospel itself that sounds utterly foolish, not what we're saying to someone, all right? And I'm going to give you a quick example here in a minute. The way that I said it is, it may very well be that if we simply insist on getting to the foot of the cross before a foundation is laid, that would be the equivalent of sharing the gospel in Spanish to a Russian. We actually said it. They didn't understand a word we said, all right? So be thinking about that too, right? Francis Schaeffer calls this pre-evangelism. So here's our modest goal, to put a stone in someone's shoe, to put a stone in their shoe. What do we mean by that? All right? Say again? Right. So have you ever been walking or running and you get a stone in your shoe? And you can go for a little bit, but finally, at some point, you're going to stop, right? And you're going to take the shoe out, or the stone out. You're going to take the shoe off and get that stone out. That's what we want to do. Put something that they're going to be thinking, and it's going to bug them. That's our goal, all right? And that's the modest goal. Now, again, if we can get to the gospel and we can get all the way to the foot of the cross, we should keep on going. But if that's always our goal, then there's going to be many times we're going to pass up opportunities, all right, when we shouldn't. Greg Kokel says, I want to give that person something worth thinking about, something he cannot ignore because it continues to poke at him in a good way. He says, that's the goal, all right? Now, some people say, well, then, see, you're not really being an evangelist. But think about this. Which one's more important? So we have someone plowing up this field here that's got all kinds of stuff there in the way. And then you have somebody that's actually planting the seeds. Which one's more important?
Neither.
They're both important, aren't they? All right? So we're insisting, hey, if you only get to this part, that's fine. If you only get to that, that's completely fine. If that's all that you can get to. Now, again, if you can go the whole way, that's great. All right? In John 4, Jesus says, here the saying holds true. One sows and another reaps. I sent you to reap for that which you did not labor. Others have labored and you have entered into their labor. He's saying there's multiple people involved. You don't know where you're at in the process when you're talking to somebody. You might be the person that takes them all the way, or you might be that very first person that causes them to question, right, and have legitimate questions, all right? So the next section, we're going to be talking about the importance of questions, okay? And I think Steve brought that up last week, right, that the importance of questions. And actually, this takes a lot of the weight off of our shoulders, and it puts it where it should be, which is on both of our shoulders, essentially, all right? We want someone else to feel that same weight, all right? Hugh Hewitt advises asking at least half dozen questions in every conversation. Now, when he's talking, he's not specifically talking about apologetics. He's just talking about conversations in general when you're getting to know someone else, that to ask at least a half a dozen questions, all right? And so that's easy to do. Asking questions is easy when you're talking with someone else. And so that's Socrates. This is called the Socratic method, asking and answering questions to stimulate critical thinking and to draw out ideas and underlying presuppositions. All right? So here's what we're going to be pushing for. Questions over assertions. Don't begin with assertions. Now, there's going to be opportunities for that, and if somebody just says to you, well, what is the gospel? Hey, go for it, right? We don't want to hold back and just be asking questions. But as far as initial conversations, I think this is really important, right? As ambassadors for Christ, there are claims which we must hold to and be willing to state, right? We must know what we believe and be willing to say those things. But there is one vital fact in a conversation which should always be remembered. And here it is. He who makes a claim bears the burden of proof. The person who's making the claim bears the burden of proof. All right? So if I'm going to make a claim, I better be able to back it up. And the other person should be the same way, right? They should be able to back that up. Okay? So here's an example. This is from his tactics book. You're sitting in a car dealership watching TV and waiting with other customers for your car to be serviced. A television news program highlights religious groups trying to influence important moral legislation. The person sitting next to you says, haven't these people ever heard of separation of church and state? Those Christians are always trying to force their views on everyone else. You can't legislate morality. Why don't they just leave the rest of us alone? Other people are listening, and you don't want to create a scene, but you feel you must say something. What's your next move? Right? Probably all of us have had something similar to that in some way, and you don't know exactly what to say. He says there are two temptations: to simply keep quiet, which is a pretty strong temptation a lot of times. You don't want to be that strange person to speak up. The second is to give a defense of the Christian position. You want to come out and defend the Christian position, right? And that's understandable too. This, however, is where we remember the above truism: he who makes a claim bears the burden of proof. This person just made a lot of claims. Why do we have to defend anything? They just made some claims, right? Our task then is much easier. I just focused on one of their claims, because they said separation of church and state. They said Christians are always trying to force their views on everyone else. They say you can't legislate morality. I'm going to focus on you can't legislate morality. Is this legislating morality, by the way? What's happening to this guy? Looks like he's being tested for drunk driving, right? So what's the assumption here? That there's a law that says what? You can't drink and drive. Is that forcing morality on someone else? In a sense, how is it not forcing morality on? Why is it wrong to drink and drive? Endanger other people. Is it a moral issue? Why is the speed limit 35 or 40 out front here? Why not 85? The same reasons. Because we think, well, speed limits, that's not really... Oh, yes, it is. Why do they have speed limits? Why is it 25 miles an hour when you're going through a school zone? That's morality. Every law on the books is one group of people forcing their morality on everybody else. Find a law that's not. Every single law is one group forcing their morality on others. Right. Right.
But why do you say?
Right. Yeah, and most people just assume all of the things you said except for the God part, right? They assume all the rest of it, and they haven't thought through. Why not? Why not freedom of choice? I want to drink and drive. Who's the government to control my body? I'm putting it in my body. Government forcing your morality on me, right? What's the difference? It's the same thing. So every law is doing that, all right? And here's how he says respond. He gives a few things. He says, ask, do you vote? Right? And then he continues on. When you vote for someone, are you expecting your candidate to pass laws reflecting your point of view? Obviously, yes. Wouldn't that be essentially forcing your views on others? Think about the debates that are going on right now. Both parties and having that, right? What is it? One group wants to have these laws that force the other group to obey whatever those laws are. We can debate whether they're right, wrong, whatever, but that's what every law is. So that argument falls flat, right? Unless the person says you shouldn't force your morality on others. And in that case, what are they doing? Yeah, they're telling me not to do something. They think it's wrong to force morality, and they're telling me to stop doing it, which is the very thing they're doing. They're breaking their own rule, all right? Okay, so that's just one example, and basically you're just going to be listening to what they're saying. Just pick up on one point and say, you know, ask them a question in response. I can't tell you exactly what all the questions are going to be. We're going to summarize them in two main points here in a minute. But just be listening to what they're saying, all right? A lot of times it's going to be a softball. So, oh, wow, that was an easy softball. And you don't even have to do anything necessarily. Be ready, right, because you have a goal. You don't want to just simply make someone look foolish, right? So here are the benefits to asking questions. I'm sure there's more than this. These are just some. Sincere questions are friendly and flattering, all right? You know that. When someone's asking you about you, even about what you believe, it feels good to be able to tell someone else what you think about something, right? Generally. You'll get an education. That's an important one. I'll give you just a very brief example, and I don't have time to spend much on this, but I had a couple Mormon guys that were coming to my house that I'm actually still really good friends with, and they're back married and living in Utah, and one's in the Army now and everything. But one of them, Parker, I came prepared to tell him what his apostles taught in the church, in the Mormon church, right? And I wanted to say, this is what you believe. And I read this whole apostle. Now, Mormons are supposed to believe their apostles. Like, they're not allowed to question that. But I had this all prepared, and I read this whole thing. And when I got done, he said, I don't believe that. Well, I just wasted all my time finding that information, because it didn't matter what his apostle said. He didn't believe it, right? So I could have asked him first, right, instead of wasting all of my time. Questions allow you to make progress on a point without being too pushy, right? And then questions buy you valuable time when you're not quite sure what to do next. And I think that's a pretty important one a lot of times, because not always am I quick on my feet with responses. Like, a lot of times when I have conversations, you're probably the same way, it's like 10 minutes later, it's like, I should have asked him that, or I should have said that. You don't think of it till later, right? Okay, so here are the two questions. This is the most important part of what we're going to be talking about today, okay? Remember this. These are the most important things I want you to remember. Here's the two questions. What do you mean by that? What do you mean by that? Whatever it is they say. And how did you come to that conclusion? How did you come to that conclusion? So, what do you mean by that is really a request for clarity. The more information you know, the better you will know how to proceed in the conversation. You want the other person to talk as much as possible about his own convictions before you reply with your own convictions or thought. And this is true. Greg says a lot of times when you ask somebody, what do you mean by that, they can't even explain what they mean by that. So just to even asking them, they can't really explain what they mean, and then they have to stop and think, what do I mean by that? All right? So here's why clarity works. You don't want to misunderstand the person you're talking with, because, of course, if you start off that way, then you're going to ruin your chances, really, of getting much further, because they're going to think you're just spouting if you're not even talking about what they're talking about, if you're not even representing their view accurately. So you don't want to misrepresent him. You don't want him to misunderstand himself. And that's I think, a key to this too, right? You're going to find out that a lot of times they misunderstand what they even think they're saying. Okay? Okay. Here's just an example. T-shirt. Everything is an illusion. Or this third mystical law, all is illusion. So I might ask somebody, you're standing in line, right, waiting at the bank or something, and somebody's got a T-shirt. Everything is an illusion. Do you mean everything? What about your T-shirt? Is that an illusion too? Right? I mean, and that might be all you have time to say too, right? Just get them to think about it. And a lot of times when people say that, they're just doing it to be silly. But some people really believe that. Hindus really believe that. That's the key part of their religion, right? They think everything's an illusion. Is that consistent, though, right? What about the words that you just said? Is that an illusion? The T-shirt you're wearing, that everything's an illusion, right? What about Hinduism itself? Is that just an illusion, right? So then why even take it seriously? It's just an illusion, right? So here's another example. It's break time Monday morning. Someone in your break room at work asks you about your Sunday, and you tell them that you came, and you explain briefly. They say, well, what did the preacher say? Right? And so you tell them, well, he talked about the gospel message and the Christian message being proclaimed throughout the world, the truth of Christianity, right? They respond, who are you to say that Christianity is better than any other religion? Okay? I think the essence of Jesus' teaching is love, the same as all religions. It's not your job to tell other people how to live or believe. Not only do you feel cornered by your coworker, but there are others who are listening. How do you respond? So here's their claim. Christianity is basically the same as all other religions. Love is the important common denominator between religions, and it's wrong for Christians to tell others how to live or believe, right? This is just one example of that in this here. And I've seen bumper stickers that have similar things on it as this. And that sounds very tolerant and loving, doesn't it? Right? But is it? We're going to talk about that here. So I just copied three different religious convictions that different religions have, right? Well, if you believe in yin and yang, you have to have love and you have to have hate. You have to have them both. You can't just have love, so it's not really a key part because you got to have hate to balance it out, or you don't have the yin and the yang. You don't have the balance in the universe, right? So in their view, hate isn't bad. It's an essential part. It's the dark side, but you got to have it, right? So then that's what that religion teaches. Is that right or wrong? Well, if it's right, then there really is no, then love isn't the common denominator between them because they believe in hate too. They believe in all these things too that are essential, all right? What about, this is what the Buddha says, there is no fear for one whose mind is not filled with desires. To him, it's all about desires. Love is a desire. You're trying to get rid of desires in Buddhism. That's the goal, get rid of all the desires, including love, right? Because that's an attachment to things. So it's not the common denominator. Christianity says God hates sin. He loves too, but I just gave the example, right? So here's three examples of religions that actually don't say that love is the common denominator, all right? I'm sorry? Right, right. I mean, I could have given lots of examples. I just posted three of them in here, all right? So here's a response. What do you mean when you say that Jesus' teaching is essentially love? What do you mean by that? What do you mean that love is the common denominator? Do you think it's wrong only for Christians to tell others how to live and believe, or do you think it's wrong for everyone? Of course, you're pushing at something there. If they say, well, it's just wrong for Christians, really? So everybody else can do it, just Christians can't? Or it's everybody? And if it's everybody, then why are you doing that to me right now? Why are you pushing that on me right now? All right? Now, again, you're not going to say it exactly how I said it. You're going to try to find gentle ways to say that, but you're trying to push back on them. All right? The second one is, how did you come to that conclusion? So I would ask the person in the last situation, right, I would say, well, how did you come to that conclusion that all religions basically teach the same thing about love? How did you come to that conclusion? Because I just gave three examples. That's not the case, all right? Which religions have you studied to come to that conclusion? Most people, they haven't. They've heard it on the radio, or they've seen it on a television show, or they've read it online somewhere, and it sounds tolerant and clever, and they're just repeating it. But it's not true, all right? You don't have to tell them it's not true, by the way. Just ask them these questions. So, basically here, in how did you come to that conclusion, you're reversing the burden of truth. An assertion such as above simply states a point, a belief. An argument adds supporting reasons why anyone should take the point seriously. When I say what do you mean by that, they're just simply restating what they believe. Now I want to know why you believe it, okay? So, here's the possible responses. Either they give you a coherent and logical reason, okay, that's a good reason for that, you might say. Or they're going to find out it's not. They give an incoherent and illogical reason, which you're going to try to point that out. Or they have no good reason, which I'm going to respond, why in the world would you believe something that you have no reason to believe? Right? Why would you do that? Okay? All right. So when someone gives you these reasons, here's what Greg says are the three P's that you want to ask. Is it possible? What they just said to you, is this possible? Pay attention to what they're saying. Take them seriously. Is it possible? Is it plausible? And is it probable? Is it possible? Is it plausible? Is it probable? Okay, so I'm just going to walk through these through here, and I'm going to give you some examples here. So here's the first one. Okay, we talked about this earlier, about some religions saying that reincarnation was taken out of the Bible early on, right? And early in the church, and they say it was taken out of there. It used to be in the Bible, right? Well, Greg Kokel says it's like this, and I've heard others say a similar thing. It's like saying to take a certain page or certain lines out of the LA Times, but to say, like, you know, last month's edition on the 3rd of February, take out line 17 and all the copies of the LA Times that were distributed last month. Is that possible? Hardly, because it's been scattered throughout the whole United States. Well, by the time the 3rd century rolled around, or 4th century really, when Constantine was in power, The Christians didn't have that kind of power, and the Bible was being copied and sent out into the known empire at that time. And many of those copies, well, most of them haven't been found until the last couple hundred years. Right? We're finding them. Now, how would they know that these copies were scattered everywhere, and how would they go find them and remove every single line? Because they didn't even know they existed, right? It'd be the same as saying, remove the third line on page 12 of all copies of the New York Times dated June 12, 2005. You couldn't do it. You might be able to get a few copies of them done, but you couldn't do all of them, right? So, is that possible? Hardly. So that claim, I would say, that's hardly possible. Is it plausible? Well, I just found these, officer, right? This guy with a mask and I just found all of them. Yeah, not very plausible, not very believable, right? And then the final one, is it probable? So here's this proposition. Is it possible that the early Christian witnesses made up many of their stories despite having no financial or power gain, right? They didn't gain any financial or power from that, while also knowing that they would likely suffer persecution for making up these tales. In other words, this is what happened to them. They were beaten, stoned. They had no wealth, right? They had no power. Why would they make it up? I mean, I would say it's a lot more plausible, that minimum, that they believed it. Now, maybe they were wrong, but they at minimum believed it, right? Then you have to start going down. But why? What would make them go from the day before Jesus died, where they were running scared, you know, when I mean, they were all fleeing and running and hiding even after he died, to all of a sudden being willing to suffer like this? Something happened, right? So that's just one example of that, all right? So, continuing on. Now we're going to talk about a few logical aids. Now, in Greg's book, he gives you a lot more examples, and so you can read some of these. But I focused really on three here. So these are logical aids to finding flaws. All right, so here's a guy sitting on a branch getting ready to cut down this tree. He's going to get rid of the tree, right? Or is he? Right? So the first one is suicide. Views that self-destruct. These are arguments that actually destroy themselves, right? We've already given some examples of that. These have within them the seeds of their own destructions. These break the law of non-contradiction. They have within them the seeds of their own destruction. They break the law of non-contradiction. Here's some examples. I cannot speak a word of English. What did I just do? I spoke several words of English, and I say I can't do that, but I just did it, all right? You shouldn't tell other people what to do. I just did, didn't I? Now, I can think that. That's one of those things that I can actually think in my mind. I can think nobody should tell anybody else what to do, and as long as I don't do it, I'm fine. But as soon as I say it, I've actually broken that rule. There are no absolutes. Is that absolutely true? Right? How about this one? This is Bart Ehrman, and we're going to be talking more about Bart Ehrman here in a couple weeks when we talk about the reliability of Scripture. Bart Ehrman was a Christian, grew up, went to Moody Bible Institute, went to Wheaton, went to Princeton, is a Greek New Testament scholar, but now he's an atheist. Well, I think he claims to be agnostic, but for him, I don't know if there's much difference. He says there are few things more dangerous than inbred religious certainty. What kind of statement is that? Does he seem to have much certainty? Is he talking about religion? Wow, that's what he's doing, right? That's religious certainty. Then he's throwing this out. And he's saying there's nothing more dangerous. All right? This is one example here. All right? So, how about this one? Talk about God as meaningless. Just want you to think about these things as a saying. Talk about God as meaningless. What am I talking about? God. Am I expecting you to understand what I just said? Right? So then you're actually saying, well, some things that I'm talking about God aren't meaningless. It's just, well, what things are meaningless then? Right? No one can know any truth about religion. Is that a truth statement? Is it about religion? Okay, there's just another example. So here is what you're shooting for. If exactly the same reasons in favor of a view defeat the reasons themselves, then the view is self-defeating. If exactly the same reasons in favor of a view defeat the reasons themselves, then the view is self-defeating. I'm going to skip through here some of my notes here to get to this next point. So here's an example here from Jehovah's Witnesses in the Bible. I have a copy of the New World Translation, which is their Bible, and I actually their translation of the Bible. This is actually their study Bible. So I found this interesting as I was reading through it to have this conversation. And their appendix, one of their appendixes in how the Bible came to us. So they're answering questions there. The people that are interested in the Watchtower Society, right? They're saying, well, how can I trust the Bible? And this is their answer. The author of the Bible is also its preserver. Throughout the centuries, scribes meticulously copied these books. Despite attempts by Roman Emperor Diocletian and others to destroy all early Christian literature, thousands of ancient fragments and manuscripts have been preserved until our day. It may be safely said that no other work of antiquity has been so accurately transmitted. Hey, we agree with all of that. As a matter of fact, they've taken that from a lot of Christian scholars, all right? We agree with all of that. Here's the problem. Two sections later, they are really big on Jehovah's name. So in their Bible, in the New Testament, they've inserted Jehovah's name, Jehovah, in 237 places that they claim that we took out. Okay? So think about their claim. And by the way, Jehovah is the most important term that they have in their belief. That name Jehovah, you have to call God by his name. That's vital to what they believe. They're Jehovah's Witnesses. They're going out and broadcasting God's name because he wants the world to know his name. And yet that most important word was taken out of this Bible that was preserved by this God who is all-powerful, they say, and using the same arguments, right? How can they have it both ways? In other words, if somebody can take 237 times without one shred of evidence, no manuscripts have that in there, right? If he can do that, how can they trust any of it, right? So they're actually, in one section, they're cutting off the legs of their argument in the other, depending on which way you want to take it, right? So hopefully that's making sense. And I pointed that out to them. You say that this name was taken out of the Bible by Christians, essentially, all right? But hold on a second. If that's the case, then I can't trust the Bible because that's the most important word according to you. And it was taken out with no evidence, by the way. All right, so that's just one example there. Okay. Yes.
Insert Jehovah in there. Insert in place of a different word that's in there already.
Yes, generally it's the word Lord, right? But we can talk about, we'll be talking about that later on, but I just was giving you that quick example. So in a few weeks, we're going to be briefly covering Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormons. Okay. Okay, so here we go. Some views can be held consistently, but not be promoted without committing suicide. Somebody can hold them, but they can't promote them. And here's just a quick example, and I don't want to run out of time here, but a Jewish rabbi from the Jewish Anti-Defamation League on national TV angrily confronted two Baptists who were seeking to proselytize Jews in Chicago. So these two Jewish rabbis were on national TV confronting these Baptist preachers who were in Chicago, specifically focused on preaching the gospel to the Jews, all right? Here's their complaint. Proselytizing, I want you to listen to what I'm saying and see if you find any fault in what they're saying. They're on national TV doing this. Now, Jewish rabbis are what? What kind of leaders are they? Religious leaders, right? Okay, so just keep that in mind. Proselytizing should be reserved for people with no spiritual conviction. By the way, do you think the Baptists had spiritual convictions? I would assume so. The Jews already have a religion, they said. It's the height of arrogance to suggest that Jews were wrong and needed a new religion. Right? Therefore, Christians should make their appeals elsewhere. So, these religious people were telling other religious people to stop doing what their religion taught them to do and take on their religion, the Jews' religion, right? Because they should not be trying to change their mind and doing it on national TV. These Jewish leaders were doing that. They were breaking every single law that they were laying out there themselves by coming on national television. They were religious, telling another religious group to change something, exactly what they were condemning the Baptists for doing, all right? So that's just another example. Now, they could have held that. These Jewish leaders could have, in their mind, said that's wrong to do that. But once they broadcast it, once they started saying it, they were breaking their own rule, all right? Okay, next. This is called reductio ad absurdum. Reductio ad absurdum. All right, and this is where we follow an argument to its logical, absurd end. That's what that little book that I was telling you about, What's Your Worldview? That's what it does in each chapter, too, from last week. All right. So here's a couple examples, very briefly. Capital punishment is wrong because Jesus forgave sinners. Mother Teresa actually was famous for saying that. Capital punishment is wrong because Jesus forgave sinners. Okay, let's assume that's true. Let's try it on. Let's see where that leads to us. Okay, this is the argument. Jesus is the moral standard for our behavior. Jesus forgave sinners instead of punishing them. Therefore, we should also forgive criminals rather than putting them to death. Okay, let's assume. Jesus is the moral standard for our behavior. Jesus forgave sinners instead of punishing them. Therefore, rapists and thieves should be punished, should not be punished in prison because Jesus forgave them. Why are we putting them in prison? What's the difference in the arguments? When I take their argument seriously, and take it to its end, you can't punish anybody because Jesus forgave sinners, right? So that's taking an argument to its logical end. Here's another one. Born this way. Homosexuality is not wrong because people were born that way. Okay, here's a response. Racism is not wrong because people were born that way. What if we find a gene that says people are inherently racist? Are we going to say it's okay? No, we're still going to say it's wrong. Right? So you can't use that argument. You could throw anything in. Pedophilia isn't wrong because people were born that way. Are we going to go with that? No. Being born some way does not justify, right? Because you could say that about anything, right? Even if you could prove that it's true.
Be careful with that pedophilia one.
And you might be right. It may be coming. Okay, here we go. The next one is called an ad hominem attack. Or personal attack fallacy. So here in our picture, can we let a shrimp like this run our great country? All right? And so what he's doing here is a personal attack. Greg Kuchel says it's like this. If someone says you're fat, they're attacking your body. If someone says you're a bigot, they're attacking your character. There's no difference. Right? Question is, though, what does it have to do with the argument? An ad hominem is nothing more than mere name-calling. That's all they're doing. It's just name-calling, all right? And so then here's a picture there, sticks and stones. Name-calling is not an argument, all right? So when someone just, you're a bigot, right? Well, what would you say? Somebody says, well, you're just a bigot. What might you say to that? What were the two questions? What was the first two questions that we had, though? Or what did you mean? What do you mean by that? What do you mean I'm a bigot? Explain what you mean by that. All right? That would be the first question I would have. But Greg Kuchel actually says something that I think is pretty good too. And his is the, he actually gives us a few examples here. Here, Christians are homophobes. Christians are judgmental. Christians always think they're right. Christians are stupid. Christians are hypocrites. You believe what you do because you were born in America and the culture you were raised in. So? And what? What does that mean, right? That's, even if it's true, okay, I'm short. Somebody says, well, you're short. Yeah? What's that got to do with my argument? And he goes on to say, he actually says, when somebody says, well, Christians are stupid, he says, yeah, some of them are. And so are some atheists, and so are some Buddhists, and so are some... What does that have to do with the argument, all right? So it has nothing to do with just name-calling, all right? He says there are two options here for dealing with this. First is ask for a definition and how that definition applies to you. Define what you mean. What do you mean by that? Please define, what do you mean bigot? Please define that. How do I fit that, all right? That's the first thing you might think of doing, or you might do. Or the next one is simply to ask, and... So what? What does that prove? Does that prove anything? All right. Even if I assume what you said is true, does that change the argument at all? All right. If Adolf Hitler says you should not hit your mother, Does that change the fact that you should not hit your mother? No. Well, you Hitler? Well, okay, but you still shouldn't hit your mother. All right? That's still truth. All right? Okay. And then here is when a question is not a question. So sometimes you're going to have people that turn it around and try to... it's loaded questions is basically what it is, all right? For instance, have you stopped beating your wife? Right? Have you stopped beating your wife? Or somebody might say, when did you stop beating your wife? It's a loaded question. How are you going to answer that? They're assuming something. If you say, no, I haven't stopped. Oh, so you're still beating your wife? You were beating and you've stopped. You see how it's a loaded question, right? And when you know that, when you know that that's what's taking place, then you're going to turn it around a bit. Someone once said that if you word the question right, you can win any debate. So here's a couple examples. Who gives you the right to say someone else's religion is wrong? Point. Who are you to say? That's what they're saying to you, right? Who are you to say that someone else's religion is wrong? What would you say to them?
Who are you to say that they're wrong?
Or, do you think I'm wrong then? Right? Do you think I'm wrong? Go ahead and explain to me why you think I'm wrong. Because what are they going to have to do?
Say that your religion's wrong.
Right. Say that my religion's wrong, right? How about this one? Are you going to take the side of science or religion? In other words, they're trying to say science and religion are opposed. If you take the side of religion, then you're standing opposed to science. So here's a question. How exactly is science opposed to religion? How is it opposed? You need to explain that to me. John Lennox says this. God no more competes with science as an explanation of the universe than Henry Ford competes with science as an explanation of the motor car. All right? Dorothy Sayers says, the same dozen tones are materially sufficient to account for Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata and the noise that a cat makes by walking on the piano keys. Right? It can be the same exact notes that the cat's walking on. But the cat's performance neither proves nor disproves the existence of Beethoven, right? So, in other words, the point is science actually opposed to religion, right? So, verbal Aikido is just turning it around on them. When you see what they're trying to do, you're just turning it around. You're going to turn it right back. Well, do you think I'm wrong then, you might say, right? Or how is that actually true, you know, what you're saying? How is that true, right? And so... last we have here, well, actually, there's going to be two more things here. One is turnabout. How do you respond when someone else begins to use these tactics against you? You recognize that, this person's trying to turn it around and use these on me. All right. Remember that everyone has a worldview and they ought to be able to defend it. So here's few things here I want you to be thinking about. First of all is welcome the opportunity to clarify your view and give reasons for holding your view. Don't get defensive. If you have an opportunity to continue on, do it. Right? That's what we want. If, however, it appears someone is only trying to manipulate or trap, which you get a pretty good idea, then you stop the conversation and ask for clarification before going any further. We gave a couple examples of that. Stop them. What do you mean by that? What is it you're exactly trying to say? Right? You want them to spell it out. They're trying to ask a loaded question. You want them to stop and really say what they're trying to say. Right? Ask the person to rephrase their question in the form of a statement. And then, what do you mean by that, and how did you come to that conclusion? Now, again, like I said last week, very few conversations are going to go that smoothly, all right? I mean, and in one sense, this is kind of like learning tennis. But until you're actually playing somebody else, you don't know where they're going to hit the ball, right? And it may not work exactly like you're thinking it's going to when you actually have someone else, right? But be thinking as an ambassador. Okay, so here, these are the main points of last week and this week, and I'm going to try to build on these each week. So if you want to remember something at the very end, when we get all the way done with this, I'm going to try to lay these out each week. Apologetics is using a reasoned statement or a verbal defense to show that Christianity is true and that all non-Christian worldviews are false. That's our goal. That's what we believe. That's what we're trying to do in apologetics. Worldview, one's most fundamental beliefs and assumptions about the universe you inhabit, and everyone has one, us and someone else, so we shouldn't be defensive because we have that. The two tactical questions, what do you mean by that, and how did you come to that conclusion, all right? So these are the things that I really want you to remember each week, and I'm going to try to build on this each week so at least you have something to take away at the very end. If you have any questions, You can email them to me at ddenny@lifepointnd.com, or you can come up afterwards if you have any questions. Any questions or comments right now for this week that I can address right now? No? Like I said last week, when this class is over, if there are things that you're really interested in studying, I would be more than happy to sit down and study things further with anyone, right, with groups or whatever. And we have the Apologetics Fellows in the fall where we kind of delve into this, right? Okay, let me close this in prayer and we'll be done. Father, thank you again for giving us really the ability to reason. Please give us opportunities this week, Father, to use what we're learning to not just think of others as projects, but to really see them as image bearers that are eternally valuable because you've said they are. And to see them that way, to not just try to win arguments, Lord, but to be thinking as ambassadors and thinking in love. Please give us those opportunities this week. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.